I'm Duarte Geraldino. You're listening to The Takeaway. COVID-19. How did we get here? Many experts say the novel coronavirus may have originated with a bat and somehow was able to get into humans. And it seems this is how many epidemics and pandemics start, by jumping from an animal host to a human. Peter Daszak is here to help us understand how this epidemic came about and why there may be more headed our way. Dr. Daszak is president of EcoHealth Alliance, which researches connections between humans, animals, and ecosystems in order to gauge pandemic risk. I asked him about the concept of cross-species transmission.
The ability of viruses to get from wildlife into people is behind almost all pandemics. If we think about diseases like Ebola, like even Lyme disease, those viruses and pathogens are held by wildlife and somehow they get into people. And that's exactly what happened with this COVID-19. The virus behind it is a bat origin virus that was also able to get into human cells and invade our bodies and spread globally.
But do we know how it actually made that jump from bats to humans?
Well, we've been looking at this for about 15 years in China, ever since SARS emerged. And it turns out that, you know, bats are very common, very diverse in southern China. People have an incredible exposure to them. And part of the problem is they fly at night. We don't really see them. We don't see that exposure like we do with other animals. The virus in bats is a fecal transmission. So bats might defecate and someone happens to, unfortunately, it lands in their meal, or even people go and shelter in a cave during the rain, or they're in the wildlife trade. People eat bats across Southeast Asia, and that's a really intimate exposure.
So when we think about that wildlife trade, do you think that it played a role in some way in the transmission of the coronavirus?
It really does look like that. And you know, the wildlife trade is behind a lot of different epidemics and pandemics. It's been involved in Ebola. It was involved in the original SARS outbreak. Wildlife markets in Southeast Asia are incredible places for viruses. People bring diverse wildlife and livestock into the market, keep them alive, and cram them together in cages next to each other. And then people are staying in those markets for most of the day, even into the evening. Kids can come home from school. They're doing their homework next to the animal cages. It's an incredible place for a virus to spread from one species to another, including people.
Just so that we're clear, because people have so many different sorts of pets, what is considered wildlife and what is not? There's that video of Arnold Schwarzenegger who's home feeding his pet donkey. Is that a pet? Is that not considered wildlife?
You know, a donkey or a horse is a domestic animal. It's a livestock. It's been domesticated over thousands of years. And the truth is, there would have been viruses that, for instance, cattle carried, that when we first domesticated them 10,000 more years ago, we were exposed to their viruses and they emerged. But we've experienced most of those. We're now looking at wildlife viruses from bats, from primates, which we make in contact with for the first time. And that's why we're seeing these new diseases. So livestock and domestic animals tend to be safe, but wildlife and our contact with wildlife is driving pandemic emergence.
So what exactly does your organization do in order to try to prevent these types of viruses from spreading?
Well, we very specifically try and get between us and the next pandemic. We go to these places where pandemics originate, and we do sampling of people, livestock, farmers, wildlife, and we look for viruses that are relatives of the ones that we've already seen. So in China, for instance, we've been working there for 15 years, identifying and cataloging the coronaviruses in bats, looking for viruses that are like SARS that could be the next SARS. We found over 500 of them, including the closest known relative of the one that causes COVID-19. We work with communities in these places to reduce the risky behavior. We educate them about the risk of having contact with wildlife. We work with governments to try and reduce two specific issues. One, the wildlife trade. Two, deforestation. Land use change is another big driver of pandemic risk.
So how can we keep something like this from spreading? Is it just behavioral modification, or is there something else?
Well, right now in a pandemic, we've got to do everything that the CDC and WHO and our, you know, state governor and the mayor of New York tell us to do. Social distancing is critical right now to reduce the size of the pandemic curve that we're going to undergo in our local area. But the longer term issue is, how do we stop future pandemics? we've tracked them over time, and we can show pretty clearly that they're going to come quicker than they used to in the past. Because we depend on globalized travel and trade so much, they're going to spread quicker. They're going to have a bigger economic impact. They're going to kill more people. We need to get ready to deal with that issue, not just the individual diseases, but the whole process. And that involves a more structural look at what we're doing around the planet in the hotspots for emerging diseases like Southeast Asia, reducing the risk around farming, deforestation, the wildlife trade, global travel and trade. We need to look at pandemics as a product of our human footprint around the planet and insure against the risk of new pandemics from that footprint.
So social distancing may be a key part of the way that we fight the spread of the coronavirus, but are you recommending that even after we get beyond the coronavirus, that we keep our distance from each other?
No, I'm saying that we can go back to life post-pandemic, not quite as normal. I think what we need to do is we need to take heed from this pandemic. This is a big one. This is a disease X, but there are many more coming. And if we don't do things to reduce them, the chance of those new diseases emerging and spreading, we're just going to see more of them. I'm talking about behavior change on a sort of community level, a national level, a corporate level. How we go around the world and build roads into pristine forest areas, send workers in without a food supply. These are risky things to do. Bushmeat hunting is natural in many countries, but at the rate we're doing it, it's going to drive more pandemics. Farming and agricultural intensification in emerging disease hotspots is risky. So let's insure against it. Let's do better surveillance. Let's get ready for these new diseases. And let's seriously look at obvious issues like the wildlife trade as a high risk. Is it worth the risk? Let's talk to people who do this, who consume wildlife, and let's understand why. Let's provide alternatives and let's give them some incentives to do a different behavior.
So what can developed countries do to help underdeveloped countries try to stop these viruses from emerging?
Well, you know, this is an interesting point because it's really a political agenda. On the one hand, we need to send U.S. taxpayer money into these regions to build their health capacity. These are poor countries. These are developing countries. They're on the front line of emerging diseases. Protecting them against an emerging disease protects us against that disease spreading. We calculate the risk of viruses spreading through travel and trade. We do this with Homeland Security to get ready at airports for quarantine and control. Every single virus that emerges anywhere on the planet, when we look at where that virus is likely to spread to, the US is always in the top 10 countries because we travel the most on the planet. So we need to go out to those regions and help them do a better job. And that will protect us here.
What about a vaccine? Everyone's talking about a possible vaccine. Any update on when we might actually have one?
Well, I think, you know, listen to Tony Fauci. He really does know. He's been funding vaccine programs for the last 20 years at least. Vaccines don't come quickly. They take time. We need to test them. We don't want a vaccine that's going to go out and start to kill people because the vaccine has some chemicals in it that's a problem. Vaccines need to be trialed during the outbreak. So it's going to take a year to 18 months right now. But I also think we need to think beyond this disease there as well. There are things called universal vaccines. There's one being developed by NIH for flu, so that instead of getting a vaccine every year to a different strain, we get a vaccine that affects all of the strains of flu. We need to think about a universal coronavirus vaccine, a universal Ebola virus vaccine, so we're ready for these pandemics, not just the one we know about, but the relatives that haven't yet emerged.
These universal vaccines, is it or would it be once a year, or is it a one-time, once-in-a-lifetime thing?
Well, the ultimate vaccines are once in a lifetime, but even that's really rare now. Even yellow fever, some people need a booster, I think. They're going to be vaccines that you'll probably need a booster at some point, and they're a long way from being developed. My point is we're not even starting yet with a universal coronavirus vaccine. Let's get that agenda out there. Let's start talking about it now so that when this pandemic's over and we've got a vaccine against SARS, we've got a vaccine against COVID-19, we also start working on a vaccine against the next coronavirus.
It's been such a rough couple of months for the world. Is there any positive that we could take from this, from our experience dealing with the coronavirus? Can this in any way help us in the future?
Well, right now, in the middle of the pandemic, I think there is something very positive and optimistic. The power to control our own risk lies within us. So we have the power and the ability to reduce our own personal risk and the risk to our community. So that's a positive thought. So listen to the advice and start following those social distancing guidelines. On a bigger scale, if the human footprint underlies pandemics, then again, that goes to us. We can change our behavior. And just in the same way that we've seen social movements around climate change and conservation, we need to rethink our relationship with the planet so we reduce pandemic risk. I think it's going to happen. I think in 50 years, future generations will look back on this pandemic era and say, wow, those guys got it pretty bad, but at least they dealt with the issue.
Dr. Peter Daszak is the president of Echo Health Alliance. Peter, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.